reached out his arms and held the young girl, who was no more than 4 or 5, in his arms. Blonde curls framed her pale face. Her eyes had been closed, but when Nathaniel held her, she opened them a bit. Pale green eyes flecked with gold. She smiled timidly at him. Nathaniel rocked her slightly, pushed her hair away from her face, and murmured something so quietly to her that no one could hear. The girl's eyes flew open wide and focused on his face. She nodded. Nathaniel hugged her to him for a brief moment, then handed her back to her mother. "She'll be fine now. She's a very sweet girl." As he gave the girl back, his hand brushed against the mother. "Oh, you too." Tears streamed down the woman's face. She nodded. "I'm so afraid, not of dying, but of leaving her alone. I wish I could be here for her." Nathaniel brushed her tears away, letting his hand rest on her cheek. "And now, you will." He retrieved the pot and continued his rounds. In this group, a different sick person popped up every few feet, imploring him to heal them. He held a brief conversation with each of them, then laid hands on them, and they were well. Eventually, that which is miraculous might become commonplace, but on this morning, it did not. Seeing the healings and the miracle of the coffee pot, a few people from the third section moved over to the believers area. The longer he lingered with the group, more and more people parked up the road and walked up, joining in. The crowd swelled. 2 hours later, he had done what he could for everyone in the second group, and turned toward the waves of hatred and vitriol that washed over him from the other side of his driveway. He held out the coffee pot, still half full, hopefully. "Tools of the devil!" a small woman shouted at him. "Get thee behind me, Satan!" Small drops of spit flew from her lips as she yelled, showering the back of the man in front of her. Nathaniel set the pot and cups down in the grass and opened his arms wide. "Do any of you need anything? Is there anything I can do for you?" An old man, bent and wizened, leaning on a cane and in obvious pain, stepped out from behind a beefy man in overalls. The old man locked eyes with Nathaniel.
"I have something for you, Nathaniel."
"Hello, Mr. Creech. Thank you for coming. I've been waiting for you." Chapter 41. Far behind him, Nathaniel heard the door to his house open. He glanced over his shoulder and saw Violet step onto the porch. Nathaniel waved to her that everything was fine. But over her shoulder, she called to John, who also appeared on the porch, rubbing the sleep out of his eyes. Violet and John fell into a deep conversation, casting worried glances at Nathaniel. He turned his attention back to Cyrus Creech, who had been speaking, though Nathaniel hadn't been paying attention.
"And I believe you are one of God's true miracles. But I know different now. No true creature of God would waste these gifts as you have done. Now I know who you are. You are evil incarnate. You ruined my life."
Creech was dressed in his best black suit, left over from when he was a powerful man in his community. The jacket hung on him as though it was on a coat hanger. The lines of the shoulders went halfway to his biceps. The sleeves were past his knuckles, and the pants only stayed up because the belt cinched it tight. "Your life isn't ruined, Mr. Creech. You are exactly where you should be, just as I am. And just as we agreed, long ago, in the time that was hidden from both of us. It will be all right in the end. If it's not all right, it's not the end." Creech's teeth pulled back, a grimace that reflected both physical pain and an immense pool of anger.
"You are clever and manipulative, but I will not listen to you. I know who you are."
"We both know each other well, though we have barely spoken in this lifetime. Still, we are of the same family."
"Kah!"
Creech screamed in frustration. He reached into the front pocket of his suit jacket and extracted the Walther 99. Around him, the crowd spread out. Their eyes grew wide, and they threw themselves away from him, leaving him as an island unto himself. The man in the overalls said, "Holy shit and Shinola!" as he jumped back. Creech pointed the gun at Nathaniel's chest. Behind him, Nathaniel noticed that Violet had recognized Cyrus Creech and had broken into a run, calling over her shoulder to John. "They'll never get here in time, just as I wanted. Sorry you have to see this. I don't know any other way. But, Cyrus, if you talk too long, you'll waste your opportunity, and you'll never get another." Behind him, Violet closed in. She shouted something, but her voice was lost in the hubbub of sound. Creech pulled the trigger with all his strength, and the pistol spit bullet after bullet. The first found its intended target, Nathaniel's chest, destroying his breastbone and working its way into his lung. The kick of the pistol was too much for Creech, and the nose of the pistol danced, dealing potential death in a random pattern. The second bullet also struck Nathaniel, shattering his collarbone and knocking him backwards. The third bullet sailed high, harmlessly heading toward the foothills. But the fourth and fifth hit Violet dead center. The impact knocked her off her feet in a spray of blood. She landed on her back, staring up at the blue sky. John jumped in front of Nathaniel and Violet, while still running toward Creech. His goal was to take any of the bullets intended for them, but they danced around him, leaving him unscathed. A moment later, John tackled Creech, driving his shoulder into the old man. The sound of multiple bones breaking could be heard in the quiet, echoing aftermath of the gunshots. John snatched the gun away from him and turned to look at Nathaniel. Nathaniel, improbably still standing, sat down heavily next to Violet.
"Is this what you chose too, Mother? Surely not. Let me fix you."
He reached his hand out to her, but she shook her head, grabbed his hand, and held it to her cheek.
"You're not the only one who makes things happen. Right, son?"
She closed her eyes tight and squeezed out tears.
"I don't have any of your gift of foresight, but if I had known, this is exactly what I would have chosen. I knew you were planning this as soon as you gave that interview. It's okay. I am ready to move on to whatever is next."
She tried to take a deep breath, but it just resulted in a deep, gurgling sound.
"Thank you for choosing me to be your mother. I am blessed by you."
"Here," he said, touching her forehead. "At least let me take your pain away."
The tight grimace on her face eased.
"Thank you. Will I see you again soon?"
"That's a mystery to me, too. My foreknowledge ends here, and I am glad. I'm tired of knowing."
Victoria smiled, then lapsed into unconsciousness, and Nathaniel felt her slip away. After she died, he closed his eyes, found her in the darkness, and rejoiced with her there. She hugged him, told him how she loved him, and went on with a happy laugh to whatever was next for her. Nathaniel opened his eyes, looked down at himself, and laughed. The bullets had cut through his flannel overshirt, and he saw that the powder blue "Come at me, bro" shirt underneath was now stained red with his blood.
"Wouldn't you know it? I'm going to die in this shirt."
John was still holding Creech to ensure he was disabled when he saw Nathaniel trying to rise and rush to his side.
"Please, Nathaniel, don't do this. Don't leave. I will miss you so."
"You will miss my music. I've known you loved it all these years."
"That would be the only thing I wouldn't miss about you, brother."
"Every problem brings with it a lesson, and every lesson carries a price. I am happy to pay this price. Can you help me up?"
Puzzled,
John did as he asked and lifted Nathaniel off the ground. Nathaniel threw his arm around his shoulder and took a few steps forward until he sat next to Creech.
Yes, this is good. Thank you, John.
You've been my warrior, my friend, and my brother. I love you.
Now, Mr. Creech and I have a small bit of unfinished business.
John eased Nathaniel to the ground, so he was right next to Creech. Far away, sirens sounded.
Come on, healer, heal yourself. I should have known you were a fake. They'll never try me for this, you know. I'll be dead before they can get a court date.
No, you won't, Nathaniel said.
He reached out to Creech, who tried to move away, but could not. Nathaniel grasped Creech's trembling hand.
Thank you, Cyrus. You have been my friend for many lifetimes, and I love you too for doing this. Soon enough you will see that this is best for both of us.
Nathaniel closed his eyes, smiled, then collapsed back into John's arms.
No! No!
Creech howled with a strength he hadn't possessed in many years. He rolled over and stood up, nimbly. John, still cradling Nathaniel, shouted,
"Will someone grab him?"
Many did. The sirens grew louder just down the road now.
"Take me back to Mom, will you, John? That's the right place for me."
John scooped Nathaniel up and carried him like a child, then laid him tenderly by Victoria's body.
"Thank you, brother. You'll know what to do from here."
Nathaniel heard the thundering of heavy paws as Brutus jumped down from the porch and ran at him with the same reckless abandon he always had. He skidded to an ungraceful halt. Nathaniel smiled at him and put both arms around his neck.
"You need a bath, boy."
He pushed the hair away from Brutus's face and looked into his brown eyes. He laid his forehead against him and held him tight.
"I will miss you."
Finally he let go and laid back on the grass. Brutus whimpered, but only a bit, then laid his massive head across Nathaniel's wounds. Nathaniel Moon closed his eyes and died. Epilogue. Typically, sentencing hearings for criminals in their mid-70s are a bit perfunctory. When you're that age, it can reasonably be assumed that anything more than a 20-year sentence is the equivalent of a life sentence. John West, who had been named executor in Nathaniel's will, pushed for the longest sentences possible. He appeared on talk shows, gave interviews, and publicly asked the DA's office not to make any kind of a plea deal with Cyrus Creech. However, he did ask that they not seek the death penalty. The outcome of the trial was never in doubt. 2 dozen cameras had recorded the multiple murders, and there were hundreds of witnesses willing to testify to what they saw, including many of the reporters and TV people who were there. Cyrus Creech pled not guilty by reason of insanity, but the jury rejected that. They found him to be of sound mind and body. In the end, the court sentenced Creech to life in prison, with no chance of parole. In the case of a man who had been given a new lease on life, that meant a very long time stretched ahead of him, all of it to be spent behind bars. As it turned out, Nathaniel had not only taken away only Cyrus's illness and granted him long life, just as he had done for so many he had touched, Nathaniel had also taken the bitterness and anger away from him. Cyrus Creech became a model prisoner and dedicated his life to assisting others who were incarcerated. He wrote 12 books over that time, decrying the sickness of dogma and blindly following without question. They did not sell well. Most of the world preferred not to hear his message. John and Melissa West, and eventually Katie, were Nathaniel Moon's strongest advocates. They guarded his name, words, and images carefully, giving it freely to causes they thought were worthy, and fighting those they did not. That, along with caring for a dog who never seemed to age, became their life's work. As the recipients of all of Nathaniel's worldly goods, they established a trust in his name and turned his small house on the edge of the foothills into an artist's retreat, where writers, sculptors, painters, and poets spent 3 months at a time creating their art. The stays were granted with no strings attached, with one exception. Nathaniel's music played in the house all day. A few of the more radical artists even came to like it. 2 years after Nathaniel perished, John also published a book, My Life with Nathaniel Moon, The Reluctant Messiah. The book told the story of their friendship, but long sections were dedicated to the life lessons Nathaniel had shared with him over the decades. It became a bestseller and was widely accepted as the gospel of Nathaniel Moon. Inevitably, different factions sprang up that worshipped at the feet of the Middle Falls Messiah, but none of those ever got any oxygen from John or Melissa, as they knew the idea was anathema to Nathaniel. As the years and news cycles passed, new stories came with them. The kidnapping of a judge, a Hollywood scandal, an airplane disappearing off the face of the earth. With each new story, Nathaniel slipped further and further into the past, until eventually he was consigned to history. Nothing would have made him happier. Epilogue 2. The moment Nathaniel Moon died, he opened his eyes in surprise. He was not in the dark stream where he had frolicked from life to life so many times before. Instead, he was in a dazzlingly white room, filled with white benches. A lovely woman with long, sandy hair and bangs sat beside him, as though she had been expecting him. She nodded at him, half acknowledgement and half bow.
"Hello, Nathaniel."
"Carrie?
Of course, I wouldn't let anyone else come and welcome you."
He reached for her and hugged her close. He inhaled deeply. She smelled of sandalwood and fresh air. She was dressed in a long robe the color of pale moonlight on freshly fallen snow. Nathaniel glanced down at himself and noticed he was wearing the same.
"You look wonderful, and it is so good to see you again. I remembered so much last life, but I had forgotten you. You've been so many things to me, over so many lifetimes," Nathaniel said. "I know it felt like you remembered much, but you were clever when you decided to bring some memories into this final life with you. You still forgot enough that you could learn the lessons this life held for you."
Nathaniel took a moment to reflect back on his most recent life, and saw the truth in Carrie's words.
"You said, final life. Does that mean I'm not going back?"
"Only if you want." Again, Nathaniel paused to think. He shook his head.
"No, I think I won't. There is so much beauty there, both in the place and the people, but I don't think so."
"I made the same choice. I understand."
"What do you do here, then?"
"I oversee those who watch the souls on earth, the watchers, who feed the machine." She blushed a little, looking almost shy.
"I brought about a change here, so now I feel like I have to stay and see it through."
Nathaniel laughed a little, nodding in appreciation.
"You always were a rabble-rouser, in your own quiet way. So, what's next for me?"
Carrie held out her hand. A tiny ball of pure, iridescent light sat on her palm. She held it out to him.
"A gift. This will take you wherever you want. The universe stretches out before you."
This is the end of The Final Life of Nathaniel Moon. If you enjoy this audiobook, find more just like it by visiting audfans.com, the premier audiobook discovery service that brings tailored recommendations direct to your email. That's audfans www.thefinallife.com. You have been listening to The Final Life of Nathaniel Moon, Book 4 of the Middle Falls Time Travel Series. Produced by Emily Durr. Executive Producer, Greg Lawrence. Written by Sean Inman. Performed by Adam Verner. Text copyright 2018 by Sean Inman. Production copyright 2018 by Podium Publishing. All rights reserved.
Author's note. Hi, this is Sean Inman. Thanks for joining me on this fourth trip through the world of Middle Falls, Oregon. This book is a little different from the first three in the series. I think of those first three books as a complete trilogy. Nathaniel's story is a little bit of a palate cleanser before I dive back into the more intertwined lives of the other characters of Middle Falls, Oregon, in The Emancipation of Veronica McAllister. Nathaniel's story has been brewing inside me longer than anything else I've written. At age 16, I already knew I wanted to be a writer. It was at that impressionable age that I read Dune by Frank Herbert for the first time. That book had a character named Aaliyah Atreides, often referred to as Aaliyah of the Knife. Through the mechanics of the plot, Aaliyah gained consciousness in her mother's womb. That idea resonated with me and clung to my brain, never to leave. Over the years, a number of other books and characters did the same. Donald Shimoda from Richard Bach's Illusions, Valentine Michael Smith from the great Robert A. Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land, and many more. They all went into this bouillabaisse that is my brain and sat marinating. The year I turned 20, I decided it was time for me to write my first novel. The only problem was I was nowhere near ready to write it, mostly because I hadn't lived enough to have anything to say yet. That didn't stop me from trying, though, so I struggled through a few chapters of a truly horrible novel called The Man Who Is. I'm so happy no one else will ever see those pages. Time moved on, as it inevitably does. Life in the form of a career and a family pushed any thought of writing out of my brain. I could never forget that story of The Man Who Is, though. At the time, I thought that man's name was John, which you'll recognize as the name of Nathaniel's best friend in the book. Over the years, when I would see various situations come up, I would wonder, how would my man who is respond to this? Essentially, I was practicing writing his story, even when I wasn't. In the late 1980s, I began to notice how the world would hold its collective breath over a single news story, a baby down a well, a pro athlete charged with murder, a Long Island Lolita, a missing plane. As I watched the endless interviews with the people in the middle of these events and stories, I noticed they all had something in common. None of them really had anything to say that was interesting. That's when the idea occurred to me. What if my man who is was dropped down into the middle of a scene like that and actually did have something to say? So, the scene in this book where Laura Hall interviews Nathaniel was actually the first scene I had in mind for the book. I had my own 15 minutes in the spotlight back in the fall of 1980. It was in the midst of the Iranian hostage situation. I was working as a producer for radio station KAYO in Seattle. The host of the show I produced was none other than Laura Hall. I chose to pay tribute to her by naming the interview in this book after her, because I admired her. I thought she was an incredibly insightful interviewer. My job as a producer was to line up the guests and then man the phones and make sure everything ran smoothly during the show. Laura and I had a show meeting every Monday morning. She would rattle off a list of the people she wanted me to book. It was an incredible gig. I was only 20 years old, but I had the chance to meet and talk to people like Charles Schultz, Nog Mandino, Buckminster Fuller, Abby Hoffman, and Anne Rule right after she wrote The Stranger Beside Me. At the end of each meeting, Laura would say, "Oh, and why don't you get me an interview with one of the hostages?" We both knew that was impossible. The American hostages were being held under such tight scrutiny by their captors. But I was young, and I wasn't sure yet of what was really impossible. So I went to work on the task. I burned up the phone lines for months, looking for any way to get a number that might ring where the hostages were being held. Eventually, I came into contact with a British reporter who gave me a phone number he thought had once rung into where the hostages were being held. He was certain it had been disconnected long since. I called the number. It was not disconnected. When I called, a male voice would answer in Farsi, rattle something off at me, I speak zero Farsi, and then hang up the phone. We played that game for weeks, getting me nowhere. Eventually, I had the brilliant idea to pose as an overseas operator. This time, when the man answered the phone, I said, "This is the overseas operator. I have a person-to-person call for Bruce Langan," in my most official voice. Mr. Langan was the chief diplomat, the chargé d'affaires of the embassy at the time they were taken hostage. The man on the other end didn't say anything, but this time he didn't hang up. Instead, I heard him set the phone down with a clunk. I sat on hold, trying to calculate how much of my station's budget I was burning through every 60 seconds. Long-distance overseas calls were expensive in 1980. Several long minutes later, a tired-sounding man picked up the phone and said, "Hello?" I couldn't believe it. "Hello, is this Bruce Langan?" "Yes." "This is Sean Inman with radio station KAYO in Seattle. Can I put you on the air with us?" At first, he demurred, but I'm nothing if not a good salesman. I promised him we wouldn't ask him any question that would get him in trouble with his captors and that would mean the world to all of America if we could just hear his voice. After a moment's pause, he agreed. I was faced with a horrible dilemma. Laura was on the air in a room around the corner from me. She couldn't see me or hear me. In order to put Mr. Langan on the air, I had to first put him on hold. That was pretty risky with our old phone system at the radio station. I said a little prayer, hit the hold button, and burst into the studio. Laura looked at me like I was crazy, but I grabbed a commercial, slammed it into the cart machine, and hit play. I told Laura, "I've got Bruce Langan on line 3. You got 20 seconds to prepare for the biggest interview of your life." I ran into the newsroom to make sure we had a tape rolling to capture the interview for history, and then I stood there with the nighttime news guys and watched in amazement as Laura, with zero preparation, conducted a thoughtful, insightful interview with Mr. Langan. It was the only interview any of the hostages gave in their 444 days of captivity. To say that chaos ensued is an understatement. In the following 24 hours, I gave interviews to ABC, NBC, CBS, the BBC, Reuters, the Associated Press, United Press International, and two guys in black suits with badges that wanted to know how I had gotten a hold of the hostages. I was contacted by a radio station in Los Angeles who offered to triple my salary if I would come produce their afternoon drive show. I didn't take them up on it. I was 20 years old and scared to death to move to Los Angeles where I knew no one. Instead, I happily accepted the $200 a month raise that KAYO offered me to stay. Of course, my little moment in the spotlight was nothing like what Nathaniel experienced, and I didn't do anything dramatic like swallow a bomb blast. But it did give me a perspective on what it's like when everyone wants a little piece of you, even if it was just for a day or two. Not long after the interview, the station was sold, and I was fired by the new owners because I was making $200 a month more than the other producers. Welcome to radio. Laura, meanwhile, did indeed give up her talk show and move to a small town in Oregon, so my art imitated life in that way as well. And now, almost 40 years after I first conceived it, my story of the man who is complete. I can let go of it now. Thank you for having been a part of it.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.